Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen is with us at a time when foreign policy has been center stage for her. Shaheen sits on both the Foreign Relations and the Armed Services Committees. And so in that role, she's let her voice be heard on American policy toward the Syrian civil war and Russia. Today in The Exchange, we'll cover this and domestic policy as well, including health care and veterans affairs. And let's get you into our conversation, too. What are your questions for Senator Shaheen? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Senator Shaheen, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Nice to be back. Thanks.
Well, last week, President Trump launched cruise missiles at a Syrian airfield in retaliation for a chemical attack that, you know, everybody saw the terrible pictures, killed scores of civilians, including children. In a statement, you said, Senator Shaheen, you supported the president's decision. How come?
Well, what's happened in Syria, not just in terms of this chemical attack, but for the last, I think we're going into the sixth year now of the Syrian civil war, is horrific. Bashar Assad's attack on his own people is unforgivable. I think he's a war criminal, and I hope he's tried as such at some point. And as you say, we all saw the most recent chemical attacks. And I think, you know, back in 2013, when we saw similar attacks using sarin gas, President Obama said he wanted Congress to authorize taking action, and I was actually one of 10 on the Foreign Relations Committee who voted to take action after that. He had drawn a red line about the use of chemical weapons and then came to an agreement with Russia and Syria to remove those chemical weapons. Well, clearly that hasn't been done, so I think we needed to send a strong message to Assad, to the Russians, to the Iranians, that is unacceptable.
Well, what about that action by President Obama that you mentioned? What do we learn from that? Because you could say it didn't really work.
Well, we didn't take action then. And
should
so
we have, perhaps?
I was one of, as I said, I was one of 10 who's on the Foreign Relations Committee who said we should take action. That legislation never came to the floor. And following that, then Secretary of State John Kerry worked out an agreement with the Russians and the Syrians and us to get rid of chemical weapons, but they haven't done that. Now, having said that, I think the president's action needs to be part of a broader strategy to think about what comes next. And that's where it gets very challenging, because I don't think, and I don't think most people in America think, we should put more troops on the ground in Syria.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about the way forward. But one more question on, again, that 2013 deal brokered at the last minute by then Secretary of State Kerry with the Russians. I mean, is the lesson, Senator Shaheen, given the close ties between Syria and Russia, should we have trusted them when they said, we'll work this out?
Well, I thought we should have taken action at that point, and I think we would have seen a different outcome. But, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, and so we don't know what might have happened. What we know is where we are now and what we need to do now. And clearly we need to put everyone on notice that using chemical weapons in Syria is not acceptable.
What did this strike achieve, as you see it, Senator Shaheen?
Well, again, I hope it made it clear to Assad that he should not use chemical weapons again. I hope it made it clear to the Russians that we will take action if we see that kind of activity going on, that kind of horrific attack. I think hopefully it made it clear to the Iranians as well and to the rest of the world. I think it also sends a message to places like North Korea, where and China about our intentions.
Shortly after the strike, President Assad's warplanes took off from the site of the missile barrage, bombed the same town that had been attacked with chemical weapons. What does that suggest about whether Assad is getting the message that the U.S. is trying to send?
Well, I don't think he used chemical weapons there. And I think, as I said, this needs to be part of a bigger strategy around Syria. Ultimately, I don't believe that Syria can continue to function as a state with Assad as the leader. I think whatever ultimately is decided, it will have to include his exiting at some point from the country. But in order to make that happen, we've clearly got to get some of the other players there, like Russia and Iran, to agree with that. And they're not there yet.
Wow. Well, and just listening to you think, I'm thinking Russia and Iran. Good luck with that. I mean, these are not people that the U.S. is used to sitting down and working things out with.
No, although we have had some very important negotiations and agreements with them. We did the joint plan of action with Iran to get them to suspend their nuclear program. We did the New START agreement with Russia to reduce nuclear weapons. So we have been successful on occasion, and we need to think about how to get there. And I think long term, as Russia looks at what's happening in Syria, it's not in Russia's interest. They have a base there that's important to them long term, but it's not going to be in their interest to be mired down in a civil war there for the next 5 or 10 more years.
You know, I'm curious, Senator Shaheen. I mean, clearly the White House makes a lot of foreign policy, you know, in conjunction with the CIA and the NSC and so forth. What's the U.S. Senate's role, and in particular your role, Senator Shaheen, in all this?
Well, Congress has an oversight role, and for, you know, whoever the president is supposed to come to Congress for an authorization for use of military force. So if we're going to expand activities in the region, that's something that the Congress is going to want to debate. And we have done that in the past. So I think we will continue to look at that. We also have a financing responsibility to fund whatever the government does. And that's a place where Congress has a very big opportunity to weigh in.
Some of your fellow Democrats in the Senate, among them Bernie Sanders, sounded notes of caution about this strike. Senator Sanders said, if there's anything we should have learned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's easier to get into a war than get out of one. He said he was deeply concerned that these strikes could lead to the U.S. once again being dragged back into the quagmire of long-term military engagement in the Middle East. And there were other senators echoing what Senator Sanders said. Do you share those concerns that we could be dragged back into what he calls a quagmire?
Well, that's what I said that needs to be part of a broader strategy around Syria and the Middle East. But one of the things that we heard from President Trump with the airstrikes was that we were not going to put boots on the ground in Syria. I thought that was positive. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we are going to see more of what a long-term strategy is for Syria coming out of this White House.
There are some boots on the ground. I know some people don't like that term, but
there are some already,
right?
There are about 1,000 troops in Syria. They're engaged in the fight against ISIS.
The Washington Post's Pentagon reporters said that there was some concern that this attack may put those troops now stationed in Syria in greater danger. They've been advising local forces in advance of a major assault on the Syrian city of Raqqa, which is the
right.
Islamic State's de facto capital, if you could call it that. How worried are you about that this strike kind of changes the balance for our people on the ground?
Well, I think there's always a concern about when we have soldiers in a conflict area about what might happen to them, and obviously they're in danger. So I think that's something we need to watch very closely, and I think we need to also, despite Russia's claims that they're not going to continue to deconflict with us on airstrikes in Syria, I do think there will continue to be some coordination there, because it's not only is it not in our interest to have something blow up as the result of miscue in Syria, it's not in their interest either.
Senator Sanders, in talking about his concerns on this, also said, as the Constitution requires, the president must come to Congress to authorize any further use of force against the Assad regime. I also got an email from Arnie just before the show started. Please ask Senator Shaheen if Donald Trump has lawful authority for an act of war against Syria. What is the constitutional right and responsibility of the president versus the U.S. Senate in this regard, Senator Shaheen?
Well, the president is supposed to come to Congress when we declare war on another country. So, as I think many people probably are aware, and I'm sure Arnie is, that we are still operating under the declaration that gave us the authority, gave the president the authority to go into Iraq.
In 2003 or
yes,
after 9/11?
In 2003.
Is this airstrike? I mean, we think declaration of war. We think of Roosevelt, you know, declaring after Pearl Harbor, entering the U.S. into World War II. Is this airstrike an act of war? I mean, it's kind of hard to discern what is declaring war and what is a strike. I'm just wondering where the boundaries are in terms of what the president can do and when he has to come to you guys and say, can I do this?
Well, and I think that's a line that's been blurred over the years.
By many presidents.
Right. And that's why I think Congress needs to act.
Here's an email that just came in from Logan in Exeter, who says, we should not take unilateral action to attack a sovereign nation that has not attacked us. Leave Syria, Logan says, and the Middle East to the Arab League and or the United Nations, and stop losing American lives and wasting taxpayer dollars. Logan, thank you for the email. And what do you think, Senator Shaheen? It's not our business. It's sad, but it's not our business.
I certainly appreciate that there are many people who feel that way. I believe the reality is the Islamic State and other terrorist groups, al-Qaeda, is still operating out of Syrian territory. And so there is an impact on us here in America if we allow those terrorist groups to continue to operate without any restraint. And so that's why we're there and why we have an interest in what the outcome is.
You know, I read something very interesting this morning, and I can't remember who wrote it. It was an opinion piece. But this person said, look, there's really two ISISes. One is ISIS in Syria, and that's why we're in there, as you said. But then there's ISIS online, you know, that's enraging people in Nice and Berlin and, you know, Florida, sort of random people who just decide, yeah, I really like what ISIS stands for. This person said that's the ISIS we should be really worrying about, kind of agreeing with Logan that, you know, let people in that region duke it out on the ground, but let's focus all our energy, all our resources on this ISIS online that can crop up anywhere.
Well, unfortunately, there are many cells that many terrorist groups, many individuals who have been radicalized related to what ISIS is doing. And what we've seen, what we saw with al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is when they had free rein to operate and territory over which they had control and could operate without any punitive measures, that they were able to create more havoc. And so that's part of what the issue is here. It doesn't do us any good to wipe out the cell that's maybe operating in San Bernardino or some other community in the U.S. if the head is still over there in Raqqa making plans and putting out all of this propaganda online.
Lots of emails coming in, Senator Shaheen, and I want to invite everybody to email us your questions and comments at exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. One more question about foreign policy, Senator Shaheen, please, and then I do want to turn to veterans issues because that's a big deal here in New Hampshire. How much has this situation in Syria, you know, the U.S. strikes, sharp disagreements, as we're hearing just this morning, with Russia over the attack, how much has all this distracted from the investigations into Russia's interference into the elections and possible links between Russia and the Trump campaign? Has that been sort of put on the back burner?
No, in fact, that's ongoing. Now, my issue with what's going on with that investigation is that it's not been transparent. I think we need an independent investigation to look at what Russia did in our elections, to look at any potential ties to the Trump administration, to the Trump campaign at the time, to look at what else happened during that period. We know that the FBI has an ongoing investigation. We also know there are other intelligence agencies that are investigating, and we know that there is a Senate Intelligence Committee ongoing investigation that uses the intelligence information that we've received. And the House seems to be back on track. The House Intelligence Committee seems to be back on track with their investigation. So I think this is very important. You know, we heard back last December before the Armed Services Committee, and this is one of the statements that made me think about this in a different way. We heard from a man named Robert Kagan who was testifying, and he said, we should all be concerned about this. This is not about whether you supported Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. The fact is we had a nation state, a major power that has been an I don't want to use the word enemy, but has been an opposing entity to the United States for a very long time, come in and mess around in our elections to try and change the outcome. They are doing the same thing. Russia is doing the same thing in Germany. They're doing the same thing in France.
They've done it in Sweden.
They've done it in Sweden. They tried to take out the elected leader of Montenegro and change the outcome of their election because Montenegro was aspiring to join NATO. So just as Russia is building up their military power, just as they have a vast propaganda machine, about $1.4 billion that they're spending in 130 countries, they also are trying to disrupt our democracies. And it's not just about trying to change the outcome of the election. It's about creating uncertainty and confusion and undermining people's belief that our democracy works. And that is something we should all be outraged about and something we should want to find out how to address, because we cannot allow this to continue. If they did it this time without impunity, then they're going to do it in the next election and the next election and the next election. And pretty soon, people are not going to know what the outcome is and who was responsible for it. So we have got to get to the bottom of this. I think we need an independent investigation, and I'm hoping that it will become more and more clear to the American people what went on.
Well, it does sound like there are a lot of investigations. You mentioned the FBI, the House, the Senate, several security agencies. Would all those entities be willing to give up their turf? I mean, I've lived and worked in Washington for a long time. I mean, it's partly ends up being a turf battle. It's like, well, no. Our investigation is really good.
I mean,
would they have to
give all
that up?
More than a turf battle, Laura, I think it's really about whether Congress is going to be willing to set up an independent investigation. And at this point, we've heard from the leadership in both the House and Senate that they're not willing to do that. And my issue with the ongoing investigations is not that I don't think they're accurate or that they're doing the right thing. It is that the American people can't see what's going on. And I think that's the difficulty. People need to hear this debate. They need to see what's happened. They need to know who did what to whom. And until we do that, people are not going to be sure about what's going on.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Senator Shaheen, coming up after a break, we'll turn our attention to veterans issues. I've got an email on homeless veterans. We'll also turn to health care and the Republican attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare. All that's coming up, so stay with us.
Know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does
the Electoral College work?
Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen is with us today and taking your questions on foreign and domestic policy. So let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. You can also watch our interview with Senator Shaheen on Facebook Live. And Senator Shaheen, let's turn to veterans issues. And here's a comment from Kelly on Facebook. She says, I'm appalled that we have so many homeless veterans. Has any legislation been proposed to address the problem? If not, will you work with your colleagues to develop a plan and legislation? Kelly, thank you so much. And I think a lot of people are appalled when they find out how many of our homeless population are veterans.
Absolutely. And we've made real progress in New Hampshire to address the homeless veterans population. In fact, there was an event not too long ago in Nashua with Harbor Homes and Mayor Donches, and Senator Hassan was there. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there, but they announced that they had effectively ended homelessness for veterans in the city of Nashua. So
wow.
We are making progress. We still have a lot more work to do, and we have a lot of work at the federal level. And there are a number of different programs to try and help address the veterans homelessness crisis that's happening in too many places around the country. There are subsidies for housing that are issued to veterans throughout the country, and New Hampshire gets a number of those. And this is something that we're looking at how we can better engage. For example, we've had a program that would ask police officers to ask someone when they were arrested if they were a veteran, so we could try and get them into programs that are available to veterans but may not be available to the civilian population.
You know, when you talk about pots of federal money that can come to states to help with these problems, where do those pots tend to exist, Senator Shaheen? Is it housing and urban development on the homeless side? Is it the Veterans Administration? Is it Health and Human Services for whatever mental health or substance abuse issues may come up? And the reason I ask is, you know, some of these agencies are slated for cuts. Some of them, probably the Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense, are not. So I'm just wondering where those pots of money are placed.
Well, I think most of the money is in the VA. But as you point out, there are pots of money in other places. And we haven't seen enough of what the Trump budget proposes, enough of those details to know how other programs might be affected. But one of the things that I'm going to do later today is go up to Laconia, because New Hampshire is the first in the nation at having veterans counselors placed in our community health centers. And I'm going to go up and meet with folks who are working on that up in the Laconia area at Genesis Health Center to talk about how the program's working and what they're seeing. And as we know, so many of our homeless veterans have other issues. They've got PTSD, or they've had other challenges that have been the result of their service. And so it's not just finding a home for people. It's also addressing some of those other issues that people are facing.
Well, another question about veterans has come up around Veterans Choice. This was the program intended to fix problems at the VA, long lines and so forth. But the Veterans Choice program, as you know, has had a lot of problems. Still, Congress has agreed to extend the program beyond its August expiration date. Do you think this program, Senator Shaheen, should be stopped, extended a little bit, or made permanent?
I think it should be made permanent. And I think we need to work on the issues that we've had. And New Hampshire has certainly had a lot of those issues. We have weighed in with many veterans, with Health Net, which is the entity that is supposed to be doing the Veterans Choice program, and with the VA, trying to get everybody to be coordinated. This is a program that got stood up very fast, and that's not an excuse, but it's an explanation for why, for one of the reasons there have been so many challenges, and we've got to keep working through those. The reason I think this is so important, and particularly in New Hampshire, where we're the only state in the lower 48 that doesn't have a full-service veterans hospital, but we've got veterans who have to travel very long distances to get to Massachusetts or to White River Junction, Vermont, for a full-service hospital, who often have long wait times. And so this is a way to help those veterans get care faster, closer to home, in the way that they need it. And what we need to do is to make sure this program is working so that the veterans who need it can use it. And that's my goal. And we are working very hard in our office. We have a regular weekly call with Health Net and with the VA to talk about what's happening, what we're hearing from veterans, and how we can address those concerns.
Because New Hampshire has a relatively high population of veterans.
We do. And as I said, we don't have the VA hospital in Manchester. I hear nothing but positive comments from veterans. But a lot of care that veterans need is not provided there because it's not a full-service hospital.
Well, and just to let folks know, again, this Veterans Choice Program was supposed to connect vets to healthcare in the private sector if it wasn't
right
close by, as you said, or if there's a long wait. But it has had a lot of problems. Meanwhile, two part-time VA clinics in Colebrook and Berlin were closed and veterans were put on the Veterans Choice Program. So I wonder how you feel, Senator Jean, if this is going to impact their care.
That's not totally accurate. The centers that were operating in Colebrook and Berlin were part-time, and what we wanted to do and what the VA wanted to do was to make sure that there was full-time coverage for veterans up there. So they have case managers that are working now in Colebrook and Berlin for each individual veteran to help them address whatever care it is that they need. And again, while this was set up by Director Al Montoya in White River Junction, Vermont, and we are still working through some of the implementation of that, but I think the initial reports are that people think that this ultimately will be a better way to make sure they get the care they need.
The number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. You can also watch our interview on Facebook Live. And Senator Sheehan, let's go to the phones. And Chris joins us from Portsmouth. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
First of all, good morning. And I wanted to first just thank you, Senator Sheehan, for your commitment and all the hard work that you're doing. And anyway,
thank you, Chris.
It's wonderful.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. I have like about 30 questions, but I'll just stick to one.
Okay.
One would be good, Chris.
Great. So I had a question about climate change and how it relates to national security. And I'm just wondering what you think the role of the federal government should be in terms of, you know, really highlighting the challenges we face and having it relate to our security.
Well, thank you for the call, and relevant for you, Senator Sheehan, because, again, as I said, you sit on armed services and foreign relations. And even though climate change is sometimes, you know, cast as a liberal issue, my understanding is the Department of Defense is looking at this very closely.
That's exactly right. And this is, first of all, let me say that climate change is real. We know that there is overwhelming evidence. I think it's only a few ideologues who still think that climate change does not exist and it's not real. We see it in New Hampshire. We see it with the warming temperatures, with the earlier ice out on our lakes, with less snowfall and more erratic snowfall, with more rainfall in the springtime. Right now, New Hampshire is getting more rainfall overall than snowfall. So we're seeing an impact on our wildlife population. The moose are down 40%. We're seeing it on our maple sugaring. So this is real. We're seeing it with the ice melt in the Arctic and what's happening with glaciers. And it's already having real consequences for national security. Right now, there are four countries that are on the verge of famine. They're in Africa, and at least two of those are the result of climate change and what's happening with weather patterns in Africa and the increasing desert coverage. South Sudan is one of those countries. Yemen is one of those countries. So We know that there are real implications for conflict, for refugee populations, for sea level rise, and that has consequences for our national security. One of the things that I talk frequently with Tim Kaine about, who is on the Armed Services Committee with me, is what's happening in Norfolk, Virginia, where we have major Navy installations, and the fact that because of climate change, they're seeing sea levels rise, and it's having an impact on roads there, on infrastructure there. So this is a huge issue, and we need to address it, and I'm very disappointed that President Trump is talking about pulling the United States out of the climate change accord that has happened with countries around the world. And I hope that he will decide not to do that, that he's talking about suspending the Clean Power Plan, which was one way to reduce fossil fuel use around the country. So this is a very big issue about the future of our planet, and it's something where we really need to work together to address it, not just here in the United States, but around the world.
Chris, thank you for the call. And here's an email from Susan. Please ask Senator Shaheen to help us understand her position on H.R. 676, Medicare for All. If she does not support the bill, is it that the overall approach to health care reform she objects to, or is there a flaw in the particular bill? What initiatives would she support? Susan, thank you, because I did want to talk about health care reform, the Affordable Care Act. And some people, like Susan, feel like the ACA was too timid. It was still based on the private sector and all the problems that they saw inherent in that. So they're backing something that Bernie Sanders backed, Medicare for All. Bunch of questions here, Senator Shaheen, but first to Susan's question, please.
Well, Susan, first of all, I think everyone should have access to affordable health care. I think it should be a right for all Americans. I voted for the public option when we were having the debate about the Affordable Care Act. Unfortunately, there weren't the votes in the Senate to pass that. And there were also some efforts to expand Medicare to cover people at a younger age. Those were efforts that I thought made sense as well, but there weren't the votes to do that. So I think where we are at this point, and I have to say I was very pleased when the House didn't have the votes to repeal the Affordable Care Act. While it's not perfect, it has provided access to care for over 20 million Americans. What was being proposed would have, in the next year, bumped 14 million people off of health care, and over the long term would have affected about 24 million people. But having said that, there are issues with the Affordable Care Act that have to be addressed. And I am hopeful that at some point we're going to be able to get Republicans to work with us to do that, to make the changes so that we have a more robust health insurance market, that we are able to address the rising cost of premiums, which and the support that people may need in order to continue to buy their own health insurance. So those are the kinds of things that I'm interested in working on, and I hope at some point we will have people come to the table to do that.
Well, and to Susan's point for Medicare for All, again, this would be, I guess you could call it a single-payer system,
right,
a la Canada or Germany. To her point on that, can you bring down costs in a system that still involves the private sector? Because the private sector, capitalist nation, their job is to make money.
Well, you can bring them down in some ways that we haven't addressed. One is the high cost of prescription drugs, which has been one of the drivers for the rising costs of health care. And actually, this may be a place where President Trump can find some agreement in Congress, because there are many of us who think there are ways that we can address those prescription drug costs that we haven't. One is to allow Medicare to negotiate with the drug companies.
It's a long-standing debate, yeah.
That's right. And that was prohibited when, under George W. Bush, they passed the expansion of Medicare to cover prescription drugs. And it's still prohibited. Well, I think that's crazy. That needs to change. So I do think there are things we can do. Do I think a single-payer system would be better? If I were going to design it, yes. But the votes aren't there. So one of the things that made a difference in terms of the House vote, or failure to vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act, were, I believe, the thousands of people across this country who weighed in and said, don't take away my health care. Well, that has been crucial, and I hope everybody out there will continue to weigh in to say, fix what we need to fix about the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, if that should include a public option so people have another alternative, then weigh in on that, too. But it's important for you to weigh in because that's the way we're going to get things done.
Well, even if the Affordable Care Act stays on the books and the law of the land, as Speaker Ryan has said, some people could lose their health care, Senator Shaheen. Private insurers appear ready to bail out or pull back on the ACA's exchanges. Humana said it's going to exit all the ACA exchanges next year. Cigna says it's not going to expand its ACA business. Anthem CEO recently made noises about what he said, surgically extracting Anthem from ACA exchanges in some markets. So these companies are getting cold feet. People may lose their health care that way, even if the ACA is on the books.
Well, that's right. That's why we need to address a number of the aspects of the law that need to be fixed to address the market challenges that we're facing. We also need to look at what's happening with the new Secretary of Health and Human Services, because what we've heard, unfortunately, from Secretary Price is that he's not going to continue to support further implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Now, he may have said it a little differently, but what we know is he shut down enrollment in the exchanges early, and he's been talking about a number of other things that would severely affect the Affordable Care Act and people's ability to get health care through the Affordable Care Act. So there are a number of challenges that we're facing. And again, that's why it's so important for people to weigh in, to let their elected officials know. And here in New Hampshire, where I think there's a lot of unanimity among the federal delegation about the need to address the Affordable Care Act, I hope people will weigh in with their legislator, with the governor's office, with the White House, with the Speaker's office in Washington, and make their voices heard, because that's what's going to make a difference.
We talked to Governor Sununu about this on our program a couple weeks ago, and he said he recognizes some of the positive aspects of the Affordable Care Act, including coverage for substance abuse treatment under Medicaid expansion. But the governor told us, we're going to play a little clip of this, Senator Shaheen, he's very concerned about the cost of this Medicaid expansion and what he sees as an eventual burden on New Hampshire taxpayers. Let's hear.
This is a program that costs, that has a cost within the state of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Now, to date, we've been very lucky. The federal government pays 95%
of that Medicaid expansion.
And the 5% is on the state's end is really put up by the insurance companies and the hospitals.
Right.
Over time, that 5% will grow to 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. That number keeps growing.
But then it stops at 10.
It stops at 10. That's a lot of money. That is an absolute lot of money. So if we're still just going to lean on the hospitals and the insurance companies to pay that bill, I mean, that's $80, $90 million. That's a big risk to take.
And so the point basically, you know, he said he's grateful that the hospitals and insurance companies have stepped in, but at some point it's going to become too great for them and they may turn to the taxpayers of New Hampshire and say, you know, you kick it in now.
Well, it still has the federal government paying 90%. And the fact is, if we don't continue the expansion of Medicaid, we have the same system we had before the Affordable Care Act and before the expansion of Medicaid, where people went to first of all, where people waited a lot longer to get health care because they waited until they got sicker. They went to emergency rooms where care is the most expensive. And then the cost of that care got paid for by all of us who have health insurance. So that is not a viable option for people who are getting their treatment for the heroin and opioid epidemic that we have here in New Hampshire. What I've heard is about 90% of those people are getting, and I've heard this from providers, that about 90% of people are getting treatment through the expansion of Medicaid. And without that, they would have no place to go. Well, it costs a whole lot more money to have people untreated than it does to have people get treatment.
We'll pick up that point right after a break. Stay with us.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the Electoral College work? Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, New Hampshire's senior senator and a former governor of the state. The number for you to join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And you can also watch our interview with Senator Shaheen on Facebook Live. And Senator Shaheen, we were starting to talk about New Hampshire's opioid epidemic, so let's go there. There was some federal money that people thought would be coming to help New Hampshire deal with the opioid epidemic called CARA, Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. Last summer in a release, you said it, quote, authorizes support for treatment providers and law enforcement efforts, though it does not provide funding for these programs. Now, for your average person outside Washington, that's pretty confusing. So does it or doesn't it help?
Well, the process for funding in Washington is confusing because unlike the state of New Hampshire and most states, in Washington, you have authorizations and then you have appropriations. And so what the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act does is authorize funding levels for certain programs to help with substance use disorders. Unfortunately, the money actually has to be appropriated. It has to go through the budget process.
So it's two steps.
It's two steps in order for that money to be there. And we haven't really seen that money because since the passage of CARA, we've been operating on a continuing resolution for most of the time, which prevents funding for new programs. So that's one of the reasons we need an appropriations process. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. We had very strong bipartisan agreement coming out of that committee last fall for almost all of the appropriations bills. So the way funding is divided up is primarily based on issue area. So you have transportation in one bill. You have I'm the ranking member, so the top Democrat on the Commerce, Justice, and Science Subcommittee. In my subcommittee, we fund those, all of those programs that are in the Commerce Department, the Justice Department, and science programs. And we had pretty much had agreement. We pretty much had agreement with the House. And sadly, after the election, the decision was made not to go forward with those bills. And so we've been, again, operating on this continuing resolution that keeps funding levels the same for all programs.
Well, we're already hearing that all this uncertainty about Medicaid expansion and so forth is already having an effect. Last week, we were told during our discussion on the opioid crisis that some treatment providers are unwilling to expand their practices or even come to New Hampshire because they're concerned about what might or might not happen. Let's just hear a little bit, Senator Shaheen, from Courtney Gray Tanner. She's head of the New Hampshire Providers Association.
New Hampshire is struggling in a workforce crisis. Providers cannot obtain and retain the providers that they need. We're struggling to obtain licensed therapists, licensed counselors, licensed clinicians. We are in a world where we're unsure where healthcare changes are going to be.
In terms of the funding.
In terms of funding. Medicaid expansion will sunset in 2020, and we don't know if that's going to be in existence after that. So providers are concerned about growing their practices if they're unsure of funding that may not be there in 2 years. It's not a smart business decision.
So here we're hearing from providers. They want to open up shop. Clearly, New Hampshire desperately needs treatment providers. What certainty can you give them, Senator Shaheen, whose services everybody agrees are very badly needed in the state right now?
Well, I wish I could give them certainty. And again, that's why it's very important to weigh in. Courtney is absolutely right. One of the real benefits we were beginning to see as the result of the expansion of Medicaid, as the result of the expectation that there would be increased funding coming out of Washington, is that hospitals, community health centers were willing to make investments in expanding treatment for people with substance use disorders. Providers were willing to go into the field. Or more people were willing to go into the field to become providers because they saw that there would be treatment there that they could provide and funding available for that. So it's very disturbing to me. Last fall, after the election, Congress passed something called the 21st Century Cures Act that provided $1 billion for treatment for to address the heroin and opioid epidemic. It wasn't all for treatment. It was also for prevention, and there were some other aspects of it. $500 million of that is supposed to go out in 2017, and we haven't seen that because we've been on a continuing resolution. But we've heard from President Trump that he wants to continue to provide funding. But what we've seen from his actions from this administration is that what they would do is deny funding to help this epidemic. You know, when he was in New Hampshire during the campaign, he said, this is a scourge. We need to address it. But he's talking about eliminating the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid portion of that that provides treatment to, you know, about 90% of people with substance use disorders. We've heard they're talking about reducing funding for programs that provide help for prevention, for recovery, for law enforcement. And so what we need is a coordinated approach. We need to work together. This is something that Democrats and Republicans agree on. And we need to provide the resources that states and communities need to continue to fight this epidemic.
Just before Congress went on break, Republican lawmakers did pass a subsidy amendment for the sickest people, $15 million to help insurers cover this population, while at the same time hoping to take the price pressures off the broader pool of healthier insured folks so their premiums don't go up. This is part of their overall attempt to, again, reform or repeal and replace the ACA. What do you think about that approach, Senator Shaheen?
Well, as I said, I think there are a number of things that need to be done to address the Affordable Care Act so it works better. I haven't looked at what was passed because it hasn't been taken up in the Senate yet. So I don't think it goes far enough to address the challenges that we're facing to help people who are going to lose their health care because they can't afford it anymore. But I think we've got to look at a whole range of things. And again, my hope is we can get people to come to the table and work together to address this. You know, the only bipartisan bill to change the Affordable Care Act was passed by Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, who is a Republican, and myself, to allow states to determine whether to increase the pool of people covered under the Affordable Care Act from 50 to 100. That was very helpful in New Hampshire in keeping premiums from increasing too dramatically last year. It's one of the reasons we had the lowest premium increase in the country. So there are things like that that we can do that we can work together to address. You know, what's the sad thing about that legislation was that he and I did not tell the leadership on either side that we were working on this legislation because we were afraid they would scuttle it.
And did they?
No, because we got it through by unanimous consent.
Well, speaking of partisanship and politics in Washington, here's an email from Michael who says, Senator Shaheen, you've publicly denounced the Republican decision to change the Senate rules regarding Supreme Court nominees. How did you vote when the Senate changed the rules regarding federal judicial appointments in 2013 under Harry Reid? Michael goes on to say, given the important role that federal judges play, as witnessed by the injunction decisions that have put President Trump's executive actions on pause, do you see a fundamental difference between that 2013 action and the latest Republican rule change? Is your opposition primarily due to the Republicans' handling of President Obama's nominee? Michael, thank you. Couple questions in there. So first off, how did you vote, Senator Shaheen, when he's right under Harry Reid, the Senate changed the rules to just majority vote simply on cabinet appointments and lower court nominees? How did you vote there?
I did vote to do that. We had 79 consecutive filibusters of President Obama's nominees.
For cabinet appointments, judicial appointments.
Judicial appointments and other appointments. And, you know, what we agreed to at that time was we would keep the filibuster on the Supreme Court because that is a court that affects so many things in our country, and the appointments there are lifetime appointments. And so I thought at the time it made sense to keep the filibuster on the Supreme Court. I still think it would have made sense, but obviously that's not the way the Senate voted.
Some people have written, a lot of people have written, Senate Democrats should have seen this coming. I mean, after you did what you guys did in 2013, you should have seen this coming. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I'm sure we did see it coming. I mean, there was some talk about that. But the fact is, the filibusters that we saw from the minority party at the time, we changed the filibuster, were preventing for several years the appointment of judges to the D.C. Circuit Court, which is one of the most important courts in the country. And it was not able to function because it didn't have enough people. So, you know, I think many of us thought that when the Republicans gained control, that they would change the filibuster on the court. But listen, this is the majority party prevented President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court from getting a hearing, from getting a vote for a year because they wanted a partisan appointment to the Supreme Court. Merrick Garland, you know, for the first time in American history, the Senate denied a nominee to the Supreme Court a hearing and a vote. You know, we've had 19 Supreme Court justices who have been appointed during election years. The most recent was when Ronald Reagan nominated Kennedy to the Supreme Court, and the Democratic Congress approved him after in an election year. So the issue was not because it was an election year. The issue was a partisan effort to keep Obama's nominee off the Supreme Court because they wanted a Republican nominee. Well, unfortunately, you know, it's not just the filibuster that's subverting the process here. It's that kind of thinking, the unwillingness to continue to do what the Senate is supposed to do on Supreme Court nominees, and that's advise and consent.
Well, and to that point, you know, again, there's been a lot of focus on this. Who's at fault for getting rid of the filibuster, you know, the so-called nuclear option? And after a while, to the average person, it just kind of sounds like, you know, partisan slash parliamentary, you know, gobbledygook. I mean, how much does this really matter to the average person that these rules of the Senate have changed?
Well, it does. And the real issue, Laura, should be on Neil Gorsuch and whether he should sit on the Supreme Court. Now, the majority has voted to seat him, but I thought he was outside the mainstream of our Supreme Court nominees. I think if you looked at his decisions around corporations versus individuals and workers, he was overwhelmingly in support of corporations. If you looked at his decisions around women's access to reproductive health, he was overwhelmingly on the Hobby Lobby decision, on a decision around Planned Parenthood in Utah. He was overwhelmingly against giving women access to reproductive rights and to the right to privacy. So he got asked multiple times about whether he thought the Citizens United and other decisions that have allowed for more money in politics, whether that was a good thing or not. He refused to answer those questions. So I think the issue here is Neil Gorsuch someone who's going to be in the mainstream of American thinking when it comes to legal issues and other issues that are going to go before the court? And I believe he is not.
The American Bar Association, as you know, Senator Shaheen, rates all Supreme Court nominees after an extensive, I looked at this, very extensive review process, and it gave Neil Gorsuch a rating of well-qualified. It's a high rating. The ABA says it looks at nominees' integrity, professional competence, judicial temperament. Why doesn't that make you feel better about this nomination?
Because I've seen how he rules on decisions. And I agree, Neil Gorsuch meets all of those qualifications. But the question for me was, is this going to be somebody who is going to continue the Supreme Court's move to the extreme on issues like right to privacy, on issues of corporations versus individuals, on issues of money in politics? And the answer to that is yes. He is going to be somebody who is going to continue that march, that activism on the part of the Supreme Court. And I don't think that's good for America.
The respected political publication 538 analyzed Gorsuch's time on the 10th Circuit Court to kind of get the facts, Senator Shaheen, of this extremist narrative. Now, they looked at his rulings in two topic areas that came up a lot before this district: immigration education and employment, and they concluded, quote, it's hard to depict him as a knee-jerk ideologue. In some instances, he's conservative, and others he's not. So they say to paint him as this broad extremist is not accurate or fair, if you look at his record.
Well, that's their analysis. I've seen other analyses that show that he's to the right of 87% of the judges who he served with. So I think it depends on whose analysis you look at. And after looking at all of the information that I had before me, I came to the conclusion that he was not somebody that I could support.
Let's take one more call, if we could, Senator Shaheen. And this is Suzanne in Exeter. Hi, Suzanne. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How are you? Good morning.
Go ahead,
good morning,
Suzanne.
I am from Exeter, New Hampshire, and I'm involved in a number of grassroots organizations that have sprung up since the election.
Good.
And one of the things we are kind of grappling with is, are we using our resources in the best way? Is this letter writing and texting and calling? And
what's the best way to be heard, Suzanne? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
How do we influence national politics? And we kind of feel like we can do stuff locally. Should we even try? You know, where should we go with our effort?
Suzanne, thank you for the call.
Yes, and that's a really good question that I think a lot of people are grappling with. And I hear this frequently from people who say, I want to know how I can help change the environment. And so I think what you're doing is good in terms of emailing and sending letters and talking to your social networks. I think that's one of the most important things you can do. If there's a particular federal issue that you're concerned about, don't limit your social network to just those people you know in Exeter. Think about not only statewide, but think about people you know in other parts of the country. Think about contributing to causes that you believe in, that you think are making a difference. And do act locally, because that's really important. And don't get discouraged. You know, one of the things that I like to tell people is about being in college when we were marching against the war in Vietnam, and people marched for literally years against the war before the government policy finally changed. And so sometimes it takes a long time before people will, at the policy level, will make those changes. But ultimately, in a democracy, things do change based on what people in the country want. So I applaud your efforts, and I hope you will continue them.
All right. And Senator Shaheen, come back and talk to us again.
Great.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.
That's New Hampshire U.S. Senator Jean Shaheen. Remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. And you can watch today's interview with Senator Shaheen on Facebook Live. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.